But when you get the lowest audible notes that one can hear on an organ, you feel the shaking. You feel the vibration. You hear that music going dun 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 on and off. So in the same way, as we live now from day to day, we experience ourselves living at a high rate of vibration, and we appear to be continuous, although there is the rhythm of waking and sleeping. But the rhythm that runs from generation to generation and from life to life is much slower. And so we notice the gaps. We don't notice the gaps when the rhythm is fast. So we are living, as it were, on many, many levels of rhythm. This is the nature of change. If you resist it, you have dukkha, you have frustration and suffering. But on the other hand, if you understand change, you don't cling to it, and you let it flow, then it's no problem, it becomes positively beautiful. Which is why in poetry, the theme of the evanescence of the world is beautiful. When Shelley says, "The one remains, the many change and pass. Heaven's light forever shines, earth's shadows fly. Life, like a dome of many-colored glass, stains the white radiance of eternity until death shatters it to fragments." Now, what's beautiful in that? Is it heaven's light that shines forever? Or is it rather the dome of many-colored glass which shatters? See, it's always the image of change that really makes the poem. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps on life's petty pace from day to day. Somehow, you know, the poet has got the intuition. The fact that things are always running out, that things are always disappearing, has some hidden marvel in it. The Japanese have a word, yugen, Y-U-G-E-N, which has no English equivalent whatsoever. And yugen is, in a way, digging change. It's described poetically. You have the feeling of yugen when you see out in the distant water some ships hidden behind a far-off island. You have the feeling of yugen when you watch wild geese suddenly seen and then lost in the clouds. You have the feeling of yugen when you look across Mount Tamalpais, and you've never been to the other side, and you see the sky beyond. You don't go over there to look and see what's on the other side. That wouldn't be yugen. You let the other side be the other side. And it evokes something in your imagination, but you don't attempt to define it, to pin it down. Yugen. So in the same way, the coming and going of things in the world is marvelous. They go. Where do they go? Don't answer, because that would spoil the mystery. They vanish into the mystery. But if you try to pursue them, you've destroyed yugen. It's a very curious thing, but that idea of yugen, which in Chinese characters means, as it were, a kind of the deep mystery of the valley. There's a poem in Chinese, which says, the wind drops, but the petals keep falling. The bird calls, and the mountain becomes more mysterious. Isn't that strange? There's no wind anymore, and yet petals are dropping. And a bird in the canyon cries. And that one sound in the mountains brings out the silence with a wallop. Like I remember when I was almost a child in the Pyrenees, in the southwest of France, we went way up in this gorgeous silence of the mountains. But in the distance we could hear the bells on the cows clanking. And somehow those tiny sounds brought out the silence. And so in the same way, slight permanences bring out change. And they give you this very strange sense you again. The mystery of change. You know, in Eliot's poem, The Four Quartets, where he says, the dark, 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 they all go into the dark. Distinguished families, members of the book of the director of directors, everybody, they all go into the dark. Life is life, you see, because it's always disappearing. Supposing suddenly, by some kind of diabolical magic, I could say, zit, and every one of you would stay the same age forever. You'd be like Madame Tussaud's waxworks. You'd be awful. In 1,000 years from now, what beautiful hags you would be. So, the trouble is that we have one-sided minds, and we notice the wave of life when it is at its peak or crest. We don't notice it when it's at the trough, not in the ordinary way. It's the peaks that count. Take a buzzsaw. What seems important to us is the tips of the teeth. They seem to do the cutting, not the valleys between the teeth. But do you see, you couldn't have tips of teeth without valleys between them. Therefore, the saw wouldn't cut without both tips and V-shaped valleys. But we ignore that. We don't notice the valleys so much as we notice the mountains. Valleys point down, mountains point up. And we prefer things that point up, because up is good and down is bad. But seriously, we don't praise the peaks for being high and blame the valleys for being low. But it is so, you see, that we ignore the valley aspect of things. And so all wisdom begins by emphasizing the valley aspect as distinct from the peak aspect. We pay plenty of attention to the peak aspect. That's what captures our attention. But we somehow screen out the valley aspect. But that makes us very uncomfortable. It seems that we want and get pleasure from looking at the peaks, but actually this denies our pleasure, because secretly we know that every peak is followed by a valley, the valley of the shadow of death. And we are always afraid, because we are not used to looking at valleys, because we are not used to living with them. They represent to us a strange and threatening unknown. Maybe we are afraid the principle of the valley will conquer, and the peaks will be overwhelmed. Maybe death is stronger than life, because life always seems to require an effort. Death is something into which you slide effortlessly. Maybe nothing will overcome something in the end. Wouldn't that be awful? And so we resist change, ignorant of the fact that change is life, and that nothing is invariably the obverse face of something. Most people are afraid of space. They ignore it, and they think space is nothing. Space and solid are two ways of talking about the same thing. Space, solid. You don't find space without solid, you don't find solids without space. If I say there's a universe in which there isn't anything but space, you almost say space between what? Space is relationship. And it always goes together with solid, like back goes with front. But the divisive mind ignores space. And it thinks that it's the solids that do the whole job, that they're the only thing that's real. That is, to put it in other words, conscious attention ignores intervals, because it thinks they're unimportant. Let's consider music. When you hear music, what you really hear when you hear melody is the interval between one tone and another. The steps, as it were, on the scale. It's the interval that is the important thing. So in the same way, in the intervals between this year's leaves, last year's leaves, this generation of people and that generation, the interval is in some ways just as important, some ways more important, than what it's between. Actually, they go together. But I say the interval is sometimes more important because we underemphasize it, so I'm going to overemphasize it as a correction. So space, night, death, darkness, not being there, is an essential component of being there. You don't have the one without the other, just as your buzzsaw has no teeth without having valleys between the tips of them. That's the way being is made up.
This concludes Session 11 of Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Our program continues with Session 12. True presents Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening from the Alan Watts Audio Archives, Session 12, The World as Emptiness, Part 2 with Alan Watts.
In Buddhism, change is emphasized, first to unsettle people who think that they can achieve permanence by hanging on to life. And it seems that the preacher is wagging his finger at them and saying, you know, like the Scotch preacher one day saying to Sunday congregation, preaching on the text, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And what about the rich food you put into your mouths? It is vanity. And the fine raiment you put on your backs? It is vanity. And all your playing around, going to golf instead of coming to the kirche of the Sabbath? It is vanity. And you'll be spending all your lives devoted to vanity, and the last day will come the day of your death, and because you've devoted your life to vanity, you'll go down to the burning, fiery, brimstone pits of hell. And there you'll look up and say unto the Lord, oh Lord, I didn't know it. Oh Lord, I wouldn't have devoted my life to vanity if I'd known it. Oh Lord. And the Lord, he'll look down, and he'll say unto you, out of his infinite mercy, well, you know it now. So all the preachers together, you should say, don't cling to this thing. So then, as a result of that, and now I'm going to speak in strictly Buddhist terms, the follower of the way of Buddha seeks deliverance from attachment to the world of change. He seeks nirvana, the state beyond change, which the Buddha called the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, and the unformed. But then you see, what he finds out is that in seeking a state beyond change, seeking nirvana as something away from samsara, which is the name for the wheel, he is still seeking something permanent. And so there are, as Buddhism went on, they thought about this a great deal. And this very point was the point of division between the two great schools of Buddhism, which in the south were Theravada, the doctrine of the Thera, the elders, sometimes known disrespectfully as the Hinayana. Yana means a vehicle, a conveyance, a diligence, or a ferry boat. This is a yana. And I live on a ferry boat because that's my job. Then there is the other school of Buddhism called the Mahayana. Maha means great. Hina, little. The great vehicle and the little vehicle. Now, what is this? The Mahayanists say, your little vehicle just gets a few people who are very, very tough ascetics and takes them across the other shore to nirvana. But the great vehicle shows people that nirvana is not different from ordinary life. So that when you have reached nirvana, if you think, now I have attained it, now I have succeeded, now I have caught the secret of the universe, and I am at peace, you have only a false peace. You have become a stone Buddha. You have a new illusion of the changeless. So it is said that such a person is a Pratyeka Buddha. That means private Buddha. I've got it all for myself. And in contrast with this kind of Pratyeka Buddha, who gains nirvana and stays there, The Mahayanists use the word bodhisattva. Sattva means essential principle, bodhi, awakening.